Well, today's actual lesson, which we don't have to get through, but we'll just attempt. Still talking about family type topics, and the title of it is How Do I Love Thee? Super melodramatic title. But the topic is just the idea of love and what it means and its significance. Love is universally popular. Like, there is nobody on the ideological spectrum anywhere who's like, "Man, we don't like love over here." Like, everyone's in favor of it, but that doesn't mean anyone agrees on it. In fact, I would go as far as to say, I don't know if there's ever been a culture in the history of the world that has been more in love with the idea of love, and maybe had less meaningful things to say about it. But love is like the only thing American culture agrees on is that's a good word. I'll trip slowly into something that might be a little sensitive, but let me give you this example that you may have seen somewhere. Okay, what does this expression mean?
In pop culture?
Yeah, what does it mean? Like, I'm not picking a fight or anything. Just, you know, what does that mean? Why do we see that on a bumper sticker?
Homosexual union with heterosexual union.
So it's an attempt to say love is a universally good thing, and your heterosexual love is equally valued and good as my homosexual or non-standard, non-traditional, whatever, you know. That's kind of the sense of the slogan and why it became popular, and you see it on a lot of things. And that's not my topic today, is not that, but just as an example of, like, why would you use that slogan? Because nobody's against love. No one's going to say, "I'm opposed to your love." That's a terrible idea. You know, it makes it immediately a positive value when you say, "Well, you're in favor of love, aren't you?" Well, yeah. Okay. Philosophically, like, this drives me crazy. This in logic, this is what's called a tautology. Blue is blue. Beef is beef. Love is, like, it means nothing. It absolutely means nothing. It's a sentence that just says, "This is this." Yeah, thanks. Now tell me something valuable, right? It's a useless sentence, but as a slogan, it's really powerful, and it's captured a lot of people. And you put a rainbow behind it, and you like convey a message well beyond what the words actually say. The words actually convey nothing, but then there's this message that's fairly persuasive, right? So that's not today's topic, except to say that love is part of the narrative in a lot of different conversations, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about what it may or may not mean. We have in our culture largely a shallow view of love, in Ben's opinion. We have an over-sexualized culture, and it lacks the capacity to discuss what sustains love outside of sex. Marriages are reduced to sex, and non-marital relationships either become sexual or do not exist. So, for example, if you talk to students about this passage from David and Jonathan, "How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." Obviously, they were gay. I mean, again, that's not my topic today. But you see that in today's context, when a modern person reads a sentence like that, we only know how to talk about love in one context. We can't imagine two grown men having a meaningful friendship that they described as love, even sacrificial love, that wasn't in some way something else. So there's just a lot invested in that word in modern culture that may or may not have anything to do with love, is my point. That was my point today. So we need to learn then. Yeah, there's a whole context to it, but we don't need context. Love is love, man. I mean, right? I mean, why use context when you got a great slogan? That's kind of what happens. We can reduce that to a catchphrase. So, okay, meaning of love. Your turn to talk. Someone give me, what is the meaning of the word love? If we're stuck with a shallow definition, we're going to have to get past that at some point. What's a better definition?
Your life for someone. Okay. Greater love has no man than to lay his life down for someone.
Yep. So in biblical terms, it's almost always expressed in sacrificial language, that it's a willingness to give up self in favor of someone else. Okay. Which is trying to walk this line of having a meaningful biblical conversation and also be aware of kind of how our culture talks about it. But in our culture, love is something you're looking for self-actualization, right? I need love to be complete. I need love to be fulfilled. It's in our culture, it's about how you find meaning and then you get love in your life. Whereas biblically, love is this thing you're giving. And of course, there's meaning attached to it, but it's always in a sacrificial sense rather than, boy, I've got to get this from somebody or I'm going to be unhappy. Yeah. What else? What other thoughts come to mind? Meaning of love.
The definition I heard was when someone else's well-being and happiness directly affects my happiness.
Mm.
I'm happy, when they're happy, it makes me happy.
And someone else's well-being and or happiness directly impacts my well-being and or happiness. Yeah, I like that. Because there's some mutuality in that. Yeah. It's good.
The warm, fuzzy feeling that you get when you unwrap that chalupa and talk about
it. That's what a chalupa gives me.
No, that's heartburn.
Yeah. If it requires an antacid, it wasn't love. It's good. Here's a passage to launch a couple of conversations about it that you've read at some point or heard at a wedding, because you have to read it at weddings, apparently. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails, is the next verse. Interestingly enough, that chapter has nothing to do with marriage whatsoever. There's no romantic context in chapter 13 whatsoever. It's entirely about Christian community and life. It applies, I'm still going to quote it at weddings, but just contextually, that's not the point, you know. Like, the point was, this is what love is, big picture.
Context
doesn't matter when you got a good slogan. Love is patient and kind. Yeah. So what do you notice out of that passage that either reinforces or adds to our definition of love that we just talked about?
One of the things that stands out in a lot of the conversations I have here is when people talk about, well, you just need to love everyone. But it here says, do not rejoice in the wrongdoing. And so loving people is also not rejoicing in their wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas in our culture, they say love is, no, you need to accept all the, even the wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, love, there's a difference between, when I usually have this conversation with kids, I usually talk about the difference between nice and kind, but it applies to love too. Like, nice is, I want you to feel okay about this. Kind is, I want to do what's in your best interest. So your dentist is kind, he's not nice, right? You got a tooth that needs to come out, he's gonna yank it and it doesn't care, like, if it hurts later. That's not nice. It's kind, it's better than leaving it in, right? So love is kind. I mean, love is the thing that is actually looking out for what is good and wholesome. It has a moral standard, as opposed to just affirming whatever it is about you that you want affirmed, whether good or ill or destructive or whatever. In fact, it's not loving to affirm something destructive in another person. That's destructive, right? How can you destroy what you love? That's the opposite. Others? Anything else stick out of that? I think it's really important for some people in the room to know that love is never irritable or resentful.
Mm.
Not naming anybody's name,
nobody's
but just
names.
Standard thing to know.
Mm-hmm.
And the best
love
way to create...
Doesn't boast.
It's not rude either, apparently, but here I am. Yeah, the good way to create irritability is to point it out, is what I've been told. Yeah. So I'd synthesize that down to this sentence, which is a lot of what you said. Biblical love is sacrificial, selfless. And then I added the word noble to get at the idea of it's aimed at better things. It's not happy with destructive things. And active. Love is not described in emotive language in the Bible. It's described in active language in the Bible more often than not. That it's love is a thing you do. Very rare in the Bible that it will talk about the feeling of love. Not to say love doesn't come with a feeling. It does. It's nice. I enjoy that. But that's not how it's often described. When the Bible wants to talk about that, it'll use the word like affection or something like that. But it's more this action, a behavior that gets acted out. So how do we know the love of Christ for us? That he died for us, right? No greater love has any man than this, right? Who said that like 2 seconds ago? Yeah.
Andy.
Yeah, Andy did. So yeah, that's it's active, or else it's not. Whereas in our culture, we talk, and we're going to talk here in just a minute, about how do you show love? Biblically, it'd be like, how do you not? Love is the thing you show. It's the showing. If you're not showing it, it doesn't exist. It's not something you have to figure out how to graphically represent with a chart. You're either doing it or it doesn't exist.
It's like in 1 John where it talks about love, like a couple chapters in it.
Yeah.
It starts and ends with love is the love, it's also obedience towards God.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be active. We need to learn the limits of love. And when I say that, I don't mean what counts as good love and what doesn't, but what love can and can't do. And what I mean by that is in our culture, we've invested a lot in love. Like, you will find ultimate happiness if you find love. You will find ultimate meaning in your life if you find love. And then you get married, and the preacher's, poor sap, he gets up at your wedding and reinforces that. Ah, this is your soulmate, and this is going to give you all this meaning. And then 10 years down the road, it turns out no human being can give you that kind of fulfillment. It's not possible. And so you're disappointed, and you go look for someone who can, which, by the way, they can't, but you'll keep looking. Because you're looking for romantic love to be life-affirming in exclusion of everything else. This isn't scripture, but it's close. It's Tim Keller. If you love anything in this world more than God, you will crush that object under the weight of your expectations. Like, no one can bear the weight of being that important to you. How weird is that? If that person's love is the definition of your happiness and your life and your livelihood and your health, you will destroy them because no one can bear that weight. God can. That's where it's supposed to happen. But when you put what was intended for God on a frail mortal person, you will crush that person. They can't live up to your expectations, and you can't live up to theirs. So I think it's very important to talk about, and we do this in premarital counseling, we'll talk about the limits of love, of like if you're not meaningfully, spiritually satisfied outside of your marriage, getting marriage isn't going to fix that. It can complement that, it can support that, it can be part of that, and it should. It did better. That's a good, healthy marriage. But there's no other person that's going to make you happy. Love can't do that. It's a short-term fix. And if it could, it wouldn't do it for very long. Something we also repeat a lot is the seven-year rule. Every 7 years or so, people change sufficiently in a relation, just individually, that they're more or less a different person emotionally. So if you do the statistics of like, when do people fight and when do people get divorces? It's like year one, year seven, year 14, year 21. Like, there's these little spikes of when that happens. It happens in between too. But it's actually kind of frightening regularity that every 7 years or so, both people have changed enough that they're not the same that they picked, right? So again, if you were picking this person of our least favorite word, compatibility, right? Look for someone compatible. I got news for you. In 7 years, You're not even the same person. So if you're compatible now, you won't be then, right? There's nobody, if you are compatible, if that exists, you don't stay compatible because everybody changes. And then once you figure that person out, surprise, they change again. So even if you could find someone who gave your life's value and meaning through their love and affection to you, give it 7 years, they'll be a different person.
And I think the flip side to that is that's where love comes in, because you want that for the other person. You don't want that person to stay the same. You want them, if you're going to love that person, you're going to want the best for them, which means they need to grow. They need to see, you know, make changes in their life and become a better person. And loving them selflessly, as we're talking about, I think makes that difference.
So you're saying you don't want to be married to 20-year-old Ben?
Oh, no.
You're glad he grew up?
No.
Okay.
In fact, I think I think the joke has been, if something were to happen where our marriage was done, I'm done. I can't do it again.
Yeah.
No.
That was not a convincing no. That was like no. Okay. And then a third point we'll add to that, which, again, only makes sense because we have a bad view of love. We need to learn ways to express love. Like, if we understood love is the expression, then the sentence, we need to learn ways to express love, would be a silly sentence, right? We would just be loving. But because we think of love as this thing I've got on the inside, but I don't know how to show you, we have to kind of learn how to express it. Basically, we're learning the language of love, which is the title of a book. You may have picked it up. If you haven't, it's worth reading. The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman just talks about ways that love is expressed differently in relationships. And it varies from person to person. Personality types are going to change how love expresses and manifests itself. If you marry an astrophysicist, his expressions of love are going to be non-standard, probably pretty standard truth there. There are different kinds of people in the way they express themselves. So Chapman's book has words of affirmation, quality time, physical touch, acts of service, receiving gifts. Stafford North thought he could improve on that, so when he wrote this booklet that I stole, he had 8 different forms of love, which, you know, is clearly better than 5, so we'll do 8. You can express love through formal declarations. Turns out, saying I love you once in a while, pretty good idea. I don't think your poem has to be filled with romantic poetry every Tuesday evening or something. Like, it doesn't have to be that. If that's what you're doing, great. But does he read French poetry to you once a week, I assume? That's what I imagine your relationship is like. Mark is reading in the original French. Your grammar is garbage. So formal decorations are good, saying I love you. Covenants, ceremonies, there's a reason those things matter. And that's surprising that I have to say that. For the first time in American history, a plurality of American adults are not married. That's kind of weird. For the first time in American history, less than 50% of Americans are married. It's funny, in the 80s and 90s, when divorce rates spiked, what everyone said was, we're gonna have like all these people on their 15th marriage, and we're gonna have a culture full of divorce and all this. And actually the opposite happened. Those people whose parents got divorces and remarried and divorced remarriage just decided marriage was rubbish, and so they didn't get married. So actually divorce rates are down because nobody's married. And that's been the consequence of divorce from the 80s and 90s, has been people who just say, what's the point of that? Those covenants and those ceremonies mean something. They are expressions of love that have value. I do a lot of weddings. We do a lot of weddings. And I take Celine along to the rehearsal because I assume the young bride has like a notebook somewhere where she's been planning her wedding since she was 5, and she's got everything laid out, and then I'll just show up and be the preacher and say, do you? And that'll be that. Instead, I get to the rehearsal night and they look at me and they say, so what do we do? And I realize that quite a lot of the weddings I do, the bride has never been to a wedding before. And neither has anybody else. So I stand at the front and say, we're going to do whatever Celine says, and she's going to march you down the aisle and tell you what to do. and I end up, you know, end up being wedding planners on accident. Those ceremonies matter, and seeing them matters.
This is a dumb question, but so there's not an order of service like in the hymnal?
Probably not.
Not for the Church of Christ.
We're not methodical enough. Like
yeah.
There should be, honestly. Yeah.
It would make everything a little easier.
I'm just asking, it's a good question.
Yeah.
I make use of the Book of Common Prayers mm-hmm. order. Yeah. I go and then I trim out the Methodist and Episcopalian stuff. I'm like, not doing that. But all the other stuff, I look at it and I'm like, I guess that's what a wedding looks like, because you need some high ceremony, you know, to say, okay, what is this and what does it mean? And the Book of Common Prayer has been around a few hundred years, and it works for that. So it's like, okay, do you want ceremony one or ceremony two? Because that's what we're doing. Yeah.
Are you saying that with formal declarations that hearting someone's Facebook post is not a declaration of love?
Oh, yeah. If you say it on Facebook,
you just like it.
Heart. If you give it the heart,
that is a formal declaration of love. Exactly.
And also, if you don't put it on Facebook that you're married,
Doesn't count.
If you didn't change your status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Hiding from students, okay?
Yeah.
Asking for a friend.
If you publicly deny that you're married.
That's the difference, right? Yeah, but the Smith, my
pre-name
is Smith, so they can't
find me. See, there's seven more of these, but we're stuck on number one because apparently just saying, I love you, was controversial to this group.
The only time they found me was because he put that he was married to me, and I was like, why'd you do that?
How dare you make a public declaration of our relationship?
Do you realize how much work that is for me?
Yeah.
You're going to have to change this thought. Formal to public declaration.
Yes. Acknowledging that you're in a relationship on Facebook.
You can write a new book and be 10.
Yes, 10.
Oh, my. Yeah. Fulfilling responsibility, providing care, building trust. Just showing up. I mean, it may sound like checking a box, but just showing up where you're supposed to be is a huge act of love. Love is being where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be there. That's a lot of it.
Thanks,
Ben. Appreciate you. I just got the yes. We do counseling, and if it's needed after this is over, we can talk.
We can schedule you in.
This is a commercial. And now, Ben's number and hourly rate. Yeah.
We can schedule you.
But no, I mean, why do we laugh at, like, when we have people whose marriage is in difficulty, how often is it one of these things? Mm-hmm. It's usually not. Let's see, in 20 years of doing this, ministry-wise, maybe two or three actual affairs.
Two.
Yep. And most but quite a lot more than that on the way to divorce. And you say, well, how did we get there if it's not the big one? You know, it's, well, he doesn't show up on time. He's not where he's supposed to be. I can't. It's little stuff.
We celebrated our 14-year anniversary Wednesday. Yay. He didn't show up.
He's fulfilling his responsibility.
14. Let me see. 7. 14.
14.
Yeah.
If you guys see him out there.
Yeah. Got to record it right here. Dell, this is for you, buddy. Yeah. Gifts. Yeah. Buy her love. No. Tokens of affection. It's traditional in the world of just the wedding ceremony, right? There's this ring thing. And in the Book of Common Prayer, you're supposed to ask, do you have a token of your love for so-and-so, right? And it's the idea of, do you have some physical object that represents that you care for her at least this much, you know? And granted, you should not turn your love into a material gift-giving extravaganza. That would be the opposite of love. But from time to time, a cheesy gift is actually a really good idea.
I love my socks.
I got Celine a pair of socks with my face on them. And I feel like not only did that mark my territory, but also it was a way, you know, cheesy gifts work. Sometimes better than meaningful gifts, I've found. Like, I'm really bad at meaningful one, but really, that worked? So gift giving from time to time, randomly, is a good thing too, unexpectedly. When they have to tell you, here's what I'd like, usually that means I'm already in trouble because I should have thought of that. Or when you ask them what you should get someone else is always a time when you...
Yes.
I was buying my secretary at Glenpool flowers for Secretary's Day. And I said, do you think she'd like these? She said, we're getting me flowers, getting the secretary flowers. I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. shared stories are expressions of love. You develop inside jokes, great stories, and just sharing those and telling those is a way to just reinforce a relationship. Married couples spend a lot of time saying, hey, remember that time? And then laughing or poking each other during the sermon. That's you, you know. Like that kind of thing, sharing life through those intimate moments and goofy moments. Someday I'll have to tell you the story about Celine and the pig. It's fantastic. Those stories that only you find are funny and amusing are what the relationship is often built on. Traditions, which for me is a cup of coffee. I don't know how people who don't drink coffee even stay married. Just saying, not naming names, but saying. traditions of like, pick something that you're going to do and do it every time. It doesn't matter how small it is. It can be in the morning before the kids get up, we have a cup of coffee. And don't talk. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's the least romantic event you've ever witnessed. It's two people drinking coffee and ignoring each other. But that's our thing. Like, that has to happen. If it doesn't happen, it's like, what's wrong? You know, like, you have that thing you check. Traditions are very important and meaningful. We just got back from 2 days in Broken Bow. There's a cabin down there that we go to. We try once a year. This was the first time in 3 years because it's been weird. But we try every year to take 2 or 3 days just to go be away from children because we love them so much. And spend time together,
well,
and that's just a tradition.
Lucas asked, well, why do y'all do this? So we can be better parents for you. I mean, it's, to be honest. It's,
if we don't like each other, we're not going to like you at all.
Yeah, we're not going to like you.
So having little traditions that reinforce this is a thing we do. Humor is important.
Mark's got that covered.
We have to throw that one in there. Know your audience.
It doesn't say thinking you're funny. Being actually funny. Laughing a lot with your spouse. Being amused together at the same things. Not everything's serious. Some things are, but being able to laugh together is an important token of love. Breaks the ice even when everything else stinks. Doing your thing with you. Finding something that they enjoy. And doing it with them, even though you don't enjoy it. Okay? What does your spouse like to do that you do with them just because they like to do it? It's a tremendous... The capacity to be bored on behalf of another person is a great act of love. I mean, preach. No one enjoys it. You do it because the other person does. That's it. I'm always trying to get Celine to be interested in some show or nerdy thing that I like, and she's like, it's great that you love that, dear, you know, and she's really good about it. She'll watch a few with me. It's like, okay, thanks. And then number 8, being forgetful, just dropping it. Avoidance is not a good problem-solving strategy. Don't ignore your issues. But it is okay to, like, set it down for a little bit in the midst of a heated argument or whatever.
Pause button.
That was one of our favorite running gags from How I Met Your Mother, which is a terrible show, but taught us so much. Marshall and Lily had the pause button where they could be having a really intense argument, and then they'd say, pause, and they would go, like, live their life for a little bit, and they'd come back to it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, if you're a ministry family, you have to have a pause button. Like, if we're having an argument in the parking lot, we can't come into the church lobby still arguing. That's a great way to be a former minister or divorce minister or whatever. Mm-hmm. So out in the car, you have to be able to say, we will continue this argument later. Smiles. Mm-hmm. And we go love God together. And then we get back, I'm still angry. But the capacity to have an argument, to know it matters, to put it on the shelf and come back to it and say, I'm not ignoring this, I'm not ignoring you, this is an issue, we need to talk about it. We don't have to talk about it every minute, every day until it's over. We can hit pause, we can come back to it, and we can see where do we stand on that. And you may have to do that several times with the same argument. Mm-hmm. And we'll say, hey, I'm ready to talk about this thing again. Okay, we're going to talk about it again. Okay, well, we didn't fix that one. Pause and come back to it again.
I remember when, I think we were married for probably a year or two, and our marriage counseling dentist, he was very adamant, you do not go to bed angry. And so one of our friends, like, we were up all night, to the point that I had to call in sick at work because we were up.
Because I wasn't going to let us go to bed angry.
We were not going to go to bed angry. And it was the worst thing ever. And nothing got fixed. We were just more exhausted.
Because the more angry, the tired you get, you obviously get better negotiators, right?
Yeah, you
right?
make more sense?
Yeah.
What?
No. Your argument gets stupider.
Yeah.
The longer it goes.
Yeah.
And so at some point it's like,
just go to bed.
Just go to bed.
Get some sleep.
And then we'll...
That's terrible.
We'll pick it up tomorrow, you know?
Come back to it. And a lot of times we have found more often than not it's either lack of sleep or we're hangry. I mean, we haven't eaten in a while. So just kind of checking off those boxes tends to give us more clarity of, okay, what is the argument really about?
And we'll tell people that we do premarital counseling for. Selena and I, we fight like cats and dogs.
We do.
Both of us are... assertive, opinionated people.
Stubborn.
And one of us is very stubborn. So we have learned it's not about not arguing, it's about arguing more successfully and how to manage that and build that into your relationship where it's successful instead of destructive. And sometimes just saying, not right now,
yep,
is the best answer, and get some sleep and come back and, what was that about? Yeah. Okay. And they're going to make us get our kids in a second. Any further comments? Think on that. Your homework for this week is to try out one of those, you know, love, and then come back and report, hey, I publicly acknowledged I'm married to you, and here's how it turned out, or whatever you got to do, and tell us how it went next week, all right?
So I can tell we're dropping that.